We are in this chapter, The Philosophy of Rebirth. And we have just completed para 16. But we started on the philosophy of the Advaita Vedanta as per the Upanishads. And yesterday we did get a preliminary idea of Advaita Vedanta, which told us about the reality of the individual, because each individual is in himself the eternal, who has assumed name and form. So therefore we have seen the first thing that we had to establish was the reality of the individual as well as the reality of the earth and the creation, because the Mayavadins had told us differently. Aurobindo says, according to the Vedas and the Upanishads, the individual is as real as the eternal, because it is the form and name of the eternal himself. But when it comes to the question of rebirth, it's because of the desire and ignorance that the individual keeps coming back to that the individual has to take so many births because of his desire and ignorance. So now in para 17, he developed this idea further. But this reality of the individual is quite temporary. It has no enduring foundation, not even a perpetual recurrence in time. Rebirth, though a very important actuality in this account of the universe, is not an inevitable consequence of the relation between individuality and the purpose of the manifestation. Please pay attention to this phrase, the purpose of the manifestation. Because as per the need of rebirth, It is there, because as long as we are in ignorance and full of desire, we have to come back. But this question of the individual rebirth, is it necessarily attached to the purpose of manifestation itself? This is something that is quite uniquely found in Sri Aurobindo. As we have been saying time and again, in fact, the conclusion of this paragraph or the next paragraph would tell us that the rebirth of the human being, if it is not connected with the purpose of the manifestation of the divine, then it cannot be called as inevitable. It is needed, but not an inevitable consequence. So let's distinguish between the need and the inevitability. He explains, for the manifestation seems to have no purpose except the will of the eternal towards world creation, and it can end only by that will's withdrawal. This cosmic will could work itself out without any machinery of rebirth and the individual desire maintaining it. For his desire can be only a spring of the machinery. It could not be the cause or the necessary condition of cosmic existence, since he is himself in this view a result of the creation and not in existence prior to the becoming. See, he tried to get this intricate meaning here, which is really, we have to read between the lines. The manifestation seems to have no purpose except the will of the Eternal towards world creation. According to the Vedanta, what is the purpose of this creation? It is just the will of the Lord that He wants to be the individual. Why should He be the individual? Why should He become the individual? Well, He would conclude this paragraph telling us that He wants to become the individual for the sake of the Leela, the play of the world, in the universe. So according to Vedanta, all this is only a play. And just as in a game you kind of invent the opposition, you say you are against me, let us have the basketball play, and you are against me and I am against you. This is a kind of a play. So where you have your enemies, your opponents, your individuals, in a play all these things are created. So too, here it says it is only a will of the Lord of the Eternal towards world creation. And it can end only by that will's withdrawal. So whenever the divine wants, He can withdraw. He says, well, game khatam, khana khatam, ghar chalo. So that kind of a thing He can create, He can withdraw. There's no other purpose in this except the purpose of the play. And this cosmic will could work itself out without any machinery of rebirth and the individual's desire. So when there is this question, as it puts it later on, for example, in the ocean we have the wave. Now all of us individuals are like the waves on the ocean. What is the purpose of the wave on the ocean? Nothing. It's just a play. The ocean throws up an individual, is there for some moments, and the wave is withdrawn. The seas remain the same, the ocean remains the same. But there are multiple infinite waves that come up, some small, some big, one this size, one different sizes, different forms. But there's no purpose, except for a few seconds is there and it goes down. So too, he says, all these individuals could be born like that and taken back into the ocean of the divine. So he says, where is the question of rebirth here? There are millions and millions of people. So is it that there is an increasing number of souls? Yes. Like we see sometimes the ocean is calm, sometimes there are plenty of waves, sometimes there are no waves. So like that, upon this creation also, individuals are there plenty. So Sri Aurobindo is telling, where is the necessity of rebirth in this? For his desire can only be a spring of the machinery. So whereas we said that the individual, as long as he desires and is in ignorance, he's bound to take a rebirth. This is fine. If an individual wants to come back or needs to come back because of his desire, let him come back. That coming back of the individual is only a part of the game. It is not necessarily linked with the whole purpose of manifestation. So here you can see Sri Aurobindo has synthesized the coming back of the individual because of the ego and ignorance. And yet he says he may come back because of his own fault, because of his own necessity, but not because he is fulfilling something of the divine purpose in manifestation. Because actually there is no divine purpose in manifestation. It is only a leela. But remember, all this is Vedanta, it is not Sri Aurobindo. So don't take it as Sri Aurobindonian view. So he says all this is done, and the will to creation could then accomplish itself through a temporary assumption of individuality in each name and form, a single life of many impermanent individuals. There would be a self-shaping of the one consciousness in correspondence with the type of each created being, but it could very well begin in each individual body with the appearance of the physical form and end with its cessation. So it's as simple as that, that the divine consciousness becomes each one of us giving a particular character to each one of us, and we play this character as we have on the drama. Each person has got a character. Somebody is a Macbeth, somebody is this, somebody is Lady Macbeth. We all play out our role, and the drama is over, we come back. So he says we all play out. The divine consciousness could come into each person, and then it begins with the appearance of the physical form and ends with the death of the form. Individual would follow individual as wave follows wave, the sea remaining always the same. Each formation of conscious being would surge up from the universal, roll for its allotted time, and then sink back into the silence. The necessity for this purpose of an individualized consciousness persistently continues, assuming name after name and form after form and moving between different planes, backward and forward, is not apparent, and even as a possibility does not strongly impose itself. This is the argument, that this question of the individual comes and goes, but in this wave, where is the question of the soul or the psychic being? Is it that in each soul the psychic being, there's the same one psychic being which comes in every wave or different waves? No. So similarly, exactly like a wave that comes and goes as a body, so too we can all be bodies with a mind and a heart and a feeling and whatever, and we sing. So where is the question of what Shravinda calls the necessity of a consciousness persistently continuous? That means the psychic being. So Shravinda says, I don't see the need for a psychic being which keeps on coming back to different forms. He further says, so he said, this is a possibility, but it's not an inevitability. Still less is there any room for an evolutionary progress inevitably pursued from form to higher form, such as must be supposed by a theory of rebirth that affirmed the involution and evolution of the spirit in matter as a significant formula of our terrestrial existence. So there is no question of any evolution of consciousness, evolution of progress of the body. There's nothing. So it is there as a static movement. It is conceivable that so the Eternal may have actually chosen to manifest, or rather to conceal himself in the body. He may have willed to become or to appear as an individual passing from birth to death, and from death to new life in a cycle of persistent and recurrent human animal existence. The one being personalized would pass through various forms of becoming at fancy, or according to some law of the consequences of action, till the close came by an enlightenment, a return to oneness, a withdrawal of the soul and identical from that particular individualization. Well, we have discussed about this idea, that is, the one supreme being gets personalized, would pass through various forms of becoming at fancy. You see, that the divine consciousness can take different forms, and some of these forms could attain by a repetition of birth, go beyond death, beyond ignorance, and they could attain an identity with the Supreme again. That means the wave going back into the ocean and becoming one with the ocean, and never again coming out as a wave. Well, in the sea the waves come back, because it's not left to the sea, the waves. But the human beings, because of our ignorance, we come back. But if we go beyond ignorance, we can be one with the Supreme Divine and forget about this individual birth. But such a cycle would have no original or final determining truth, which would give it any significance. There's nothing for which it would be necessary. It would be purely a play, a leela. But if it is once admitted that the spirit has involved itself in the inconscience and is manifesting itself in the individual being by an evolutionary gradation, then the whole process assumes meaning and consistence. The progressive ascent of the individual becomes a keynote of this cosmic significance, and the rebirth of the soul in the body becomes a natural and unavoidable consequence of the truth of the becoming and its inherent law. The last line is the most significant line. Rebirth is an indispensable machinery for the working out of a spiritual evolution. It is the only possible effective condition, the obvious dynamic process of such a manifestation in the material universe. So this is in fact almost the conclusion, but he brings it right in the middle of the chapter, because after that he is going to develop. Till now he has spoken about other theories and concluded saying the rebirth is an indispensable machinery for the working out of a spiritual evolution. Whereas he says this question of the spiritual evolution does not come in any other philosophy, including the philosophy of the Vedanta. So he would tell us that it is only by an integral philosophy which admits an involution and an evolution, an involution of the divine consciousness in inconscient and an evolution of the same consciousness from level to level, from the life level to the animal level to the human level, where the psychic being for the first time takes a form and an entity, but it must keep on moving forward because man is not the ultimate creation of nature. The imperfections of man are far too many to say that evolution will take a halt at this spot. So he would say the same soul which has come from innumerable births in the animal and the plant life just come to the human level, but this is only the beginning of an ascent towards the divine. So he would tell that this ascent or this spiritual growth is the essential condition and meaning of this manifestation. It is only in this context that you can think that the rebirth becomes an inevitable process. Otherwise, if you speak about rebirth without the word of spiritual evolution, we can always argue that it's not necessary. But once you link up the question of spiritual evolution, then as Sri Aurobindo says, it is the only possible effective condition, the obvious dynamic process. So having kind of declared his position, now Sri Aurobindo will take up a detailed explanation of his own philosophy. So right from this para 19, for the next 11 paragraphs, this is ala Sri Aurobindo. Our explanation of the evolution in matter is that the universe is a self-creative process of a supreme reality whose presence makes spirit the substance of things. All things are there as the spirit's powers and means and forms of manifestation. An infinite existence, an infinite consciousness, an infinite force and will, an infinite delight of being is the reality secret behind the appearances of the universe. Its divine supermind or Gnosis has arranged the cosmic order, but arranged it indirectly through the three subordinate and limiting terms of which we are conscious here: mind, life and matter. Well, now most of this you know, because now he is giving a kind of a summary of his own stand of evolution and involution. So he would tell us this: all this entire creation has been created not by Brahman directly, as we say. Normally in the Vedanta we would say Brahman has created this or become this universe. But instead he would say that it is the divine supermind which has arranged the cosmic order. So you see, there's a little difference in Sri Aurobindo when it comes to the creation or the manifestation of this world. It is true that it is the Sachidananda who has become, no doubt about that. But in this becoming, there were infinite possibilities. In fact, in the next chapter, The Order of the Worlds, Sri Aurobindo would suggest that there could have been a universe without matter. That Sachidananda could have formed a universe purely out of mental substance, not necessary to have this matter. There could have been a world where there is only the forms of life energy without any matter. So there could have been many possibilities. So don't think that this earth or this manifestation was the only choice. But who chose this? Who decided upon this? Well, you would say Sachidananda. But Sachidananda himself kind of puts forward the supramental consciousness or the Gnosis, which is kind of given the role to say that you choose now. You know, like in the creation, the mother said, the divine told the mother, you create. And the mother tells four other powers, you go and create for this, kind of a subcontracting. The divine told the mother to create, and the mother gives a contract of creation to four other beings. And those four other beings, they made a mess of this world. The contractors were not good enough. So similarly here, the contract was given to the supermind to create. So it is the supermind which is part of the divine consciousness, is nothing but the same divine consciousness, to say that you choose. So it is the supermind which has selected this process of involution. That's why Sri Aurobindo is calling it, that it is the Gnosis which has arranged the cosmic order. Remember that word, that's why I'm explaining all that, because of this simple word there. And in this cosmic order, there are this mind, life and matter. There are other levels, but what we know are these three levels of mind, matter and life. So the material universe is the lowest stage of a downward plunge in the manifestation. An involution of the manifested being of the triune reality into an apparent nescience of itself, that which we now call the inconscient. But out of this nescience, the evolution of that manifested being into a recovered self-awareness was from the very first inevitable. So you see the word inevitable. What was inevitable? That the Supreme should come out of this nescience and reveal himself once again, or better word perhaps would be, discover himself in the process and find out once again his superconscious level. So he says, see, the Supreme plunged himself into the inconscience, and from inconscience the reverse process begins, and that was inevitable. And the reverse process, it is Sri Aurobindo uses the word inevitable, because you know, I don't know, there is a, you know, we used to play a game with a little rubber ball attached to a kind of a string, yo-yo or something you call it, isn't it? It's a yo-yo or something. You throw it, after a point it comes back. So involution and evolution are like that. The involution is throwing that yo-yo, but after a kind of a climax point, it has to return. And it returns back into my hand. That is the inevitability of the evolution. That's why the word evolution can be used. That there is the inevitable movement is itself ingrained in the evolutionary process. Because the yo-yo, if it is, say, 2 feet of the string, then it cannot go beyond 2 feet. Once it reaches the 2 feet, it has to return. So in this involution, there is an ingrained return movement that was already preordained. So it couldn't have gone beyond the nescience level. So it went into the nescience and then it starts coming back. And that return movement is evolution. So Sri Aurobindo uses the word inevitable. It was inevitable because that which is involved must evolve. For it is not only there as an existence, a force hidden in its apparent opposite, and every such force must in its utmost, inmost nature be moved to find itself, to realize itself, to realize itself into play. But it is the reality of that which conceals it. It is the self which the nations has lost, and which therefore it must be the whole secret meaning, the constant drift of its action to seek for and recover. So this is the movement. You see, when we said it is preordained, how do we explain it philosophically? You see, what is it that went into the inconscience? Satchitananda himself. Satchitananda means what? There is a sat, existence, there is a delight, plus there is tapas, don't forget that. So the tapas, the energy, the force has also gone into inconscience. But where there is energy, what does it mean? There's got to be movement. Energy doesn't lay still for eternity. So because of this chit tapas there, somewhere, sometime or the other, maybe 1 million years, 5 million years, doesn't matter. But then somewhere the energy starts moving. Because that's the nature of energy. It doesn't remain static. It moves. That is the first canto of Savitri. This return movement, inconscience teased ignorance to awake. That is the teasing. That is the awakening. So inconscience started awakening because of the first movement of force. But also, how does this movement begin? That's an interesting thing. When and how? Because all these years, millennia, millions of years, the energy was quiet. But when does it start moving? That's the point where Savitri opens its first canto. You can imagine what Sri Aurobindo or the mother has said about Savitri. It gives the whole process of creation itself. So this is the creation. So it was that hour before the gods awake. There is nothing, there is no sunlight, is not yet awakening, waking hour, is the darkness. But in that darkness, across the path of the great event, So what is that event? It is the movement, the first movement of this chittapas. But how did that chittapas move? Because there is a something of light that descends and touches the darkness. That descent of the first ray, it is as if goes and wakes up, shakes up the inconscient and puts the force into a dynamism. And that descent of light is the descent of love. And that descent of love is what we say, the first avatar. So avatars are not just his dashavatara. Avatarhood began those times, if at all we can call it a time. So for the first time the light came as love and touched the chittapas dormant in the inconscient. And with that touch of love, the movement of evolution began. So this is the beautiful opening of Savitri. So you can see where Savitri begins, right from the first movement of creation itself, of evolutionary creation. So that is what we see here. Sri Aurobindo is describing. I have to tell you all this just because of this phrase where he says, and every such force must in its inmost nature be moved to find itself, to realize itself, to release itself into play, but it is the reality of that which conceals it. And then he says, the constant drift of its action to seek for and recover. Recover its own consciousness, recover its own superconscious. It is through the conscious individual being that this recovery is possible. It is in him that the evolving consciousness becomes organized and capable of awakening to its own reality. The immense importance of the individual being, which increases as he rises in the scale, is a most remarkable and significant fact of a universe which started without consciousness and without individuality in an undifferentiated nations. You see, what a great stress he says. The immense importance of the individual being is the most remarkable and significant fact of a universe which started without consciousness. So now you can see the importance of the individual is that it is only through the individual that this evolving consciousness is capable of awakening to its own reality. So why did the divine create the individual? He could have remained in the inconscient level. He could have been just this matter, a broad sheet of matter. He could have remained there millions of years for eternity. But remember, the whole meaning of evolution is self-recovery. He puts it here, recovering to oneself, recovery of oneself. So how will you recover? It was just a plain sheet of matter. How can you recover? Because for recovering, somebody has to aspire. Somebody needs to have the desire to know. And that somebody is the individual. And that individual started with an atom. Maybe a little cell, an individual cell in the sea. But the movement began with that amoeba, a single cellular organism. But from that amoeba came this human being. And now the human being is held responsible for hastening this recovery process. That is why he gives this immense importance, saying that he is the most remarkable and significant fact of a universe, the individual, and especially the individual human being, because he alone can make this process of recovery meaningful and hasten it. So he says, this importance can only be justified if the self as individual is no less real than the self as cosmic being or spirit, and both are powers of the eternal. So this individual human being becomes important if and only if there is within this individual the divine self. Otherwise, if it's just like the ocean waves are also individual. But they are not important. They are just forms of the individual growth of the ocean and go back. But we, the human beings, are forms of the divine, with the divine aspect within us, the soul and the psychic being. So he says, we are important only, our importance is justified if the self as the individual is no less real than the self. That means if we have the psychic being, then only are we justified, is the importance given to us justifiable. It is only so that can be explained the necessity for the growth of the individual and his discovery of himself as a condition for the discovery of the cosmic self and consciousness and of a supreme reality. So it is only so that can be explained. That means if there is an individual within the human being, then what happens? You see, again try to understand, why should the individual have the soul? And we said this wave has no soul. Not in the sixth sense, but as the aspiration. Because you see, from the level of matter to the human beings, there has been a spark of the soul, no doubt about it. But when it has come to the human level, the spark has become the psychic being. Means what? It has taken a body, an entity, a form. It has become a conscious being, as Shivananda calls it, a conscious self. What do we mean by conscious self? It has become conscious that I am the divine. Up until the level of man, it was there in the elephant and in the grasshopper and the snake and the bird and the buffalo. But there the psychic being didn't say, I am the divine. Now in the human being, for the first time, it says, oh my God, I am the same divine, the transcendent divine. But the moment it realizes that I am the divine, it wants to reach that divine, it wants to go back to that divinity, it wants to merge with that divinity. So there is this movement, the upward movement, what Shivananda calls here, that in the individual necessity for the growth of the individual and his discovery of himself as a condition for the discovery of the cosmic self. So there is a necessity of the psychic being in the individual, because it is the same psychic being which recognizes its parent. And because of this recognition, there is the aspiration. So this entire human culture and civilization is nothing but an aspiration to go towards the divine. And that aspiration, for Sri Aurobindo, opens up, if you remember, I mean that first paragraph which we always quote, that aspiration takes the form of aspiration for God, life, freedom, immortality. That's why we say the first paragraph of the Life Divine is almost a summary of the Life Divine. So that aspiration, which started with the recognition of the soul, takes the form of some people aspire for God, some for knowledge, some for life, some for immortality. And ultimately we see, if we adopt this solution, this is the first result, the reality of the persistent individual. But from that first consequence, the other result follows. The rebirth of some kind is no longer a possible machinery which may or may not be accepted. It becomes a necessity, an inevitable outcome of the root nature of our existence. So first he says, we must understand that there is this psychic being within the human being. And once we accept the psychic being, then the rebirth becomes inevitable. But hold on. So say the Vedas and the Vedanta, that we have a soul. But then why did we say in Vedanta, the inevitability of rebirth is not there? But how does it happen in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy? The given facts are the same. They said you have a soul, and we, Sri Aurobindo says we have a soul of the psychic being. But there it is not inevitable, here it is inevitable. Now you know the answer. Because in Vedanta and in Sri Aurobindo, the purpose of the manifestation of the divine is different. There it is only a leela of the divine. Whereas here, it is a self-discovery of the divine upon earth. So this, the motivation, the purpose being different, the whole argument gets separated. So please remember, when we talk of rebirth, always speak about it in the context of the spiritual evolution of man and the purpose of the divine manifestation. That is why Sri Aurobindo has taken laborious pain to write these books like The Life Divine and all the other books, in order to tell man again and again in different forms, through synthesis, through political works, social works, through foundations of Indian culture, through future poetry, take any book and every book, it is the same message, that the manifestation of the divine has a purpose. It is not a meaningless leela. So you can imagine why he has taken that labor to write a book like this. Because he has to change this entire mindset of humanity. One mindset says the world is an illusion. The other mindset says this world is suffering. Even Gita says, Anityam Asukam Imam. This is all a suffering world. Come out. So ultimately nobody has really talked about the meaning of this world. It has a temporary meaning, it has no meaning, it is an illusion, all kinds of negative things. So it's for the first time, including the Vedanta, remember. Vedanta has said about the talked about the reality of this world, but a reality which is temporary. So you can imagine what Sri Aurobindo has done is he has gone against the flow of these millions of thousands of years of human thinking. You can imagine one man trying to push back a whole Ganges starting from the Himalayas. And he's standing there near Bay of Bengal, pushing the Ganges back to his Gangotri. I mean, what a massive consciousness it must be. So no wonder what we are reading is that avataric effort. So do not take Sri Aurobindo, okay, has given a new philosophy, integral philosophy. But see the consciousness behind it, pushing back this whole mindset and then replanting in the mindset a new ideal, saying, oh mankind, this is not just a leela, it is not an illusion, it is not a nirvanic place, it is not even a place of sorrow and suffering, anityam asukam. There is a divine purpose. Every moment is imbued with a meaning and a purpose, if only we can look at it that way. And that is why he says, all life is yoga. All life can be yoga. Because yoga means union with the divine. So if there's a divine in everything, there's a meaning in every action and thought and feeling, see the divine in all of them and you will meet the divine in every one of them. I mean, one gets, so amazingly, one's mind becomes humbled when it looks at Sri Aurobindo. What a titanic work he has done. That is why we cannot understand the amount of work that he has done. Maybe people in the future will understand. Now we are just at the beginning of this movement.